after working with like Dan and Zhao and seeing how much passion they have for that cuisine, just and not only Chinese cuisine but just Asian cuisine in general, it kind of like it really ignited something in me that actually, you know, really wanted to keep doing it.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. We've heard from many who, against their parents' wishes, began a career in hospitality, all with the opinion, if you do something you love, you'll make a success of it. The success of those truly passionate about what they do is part of the beauty and magic of the offering in the restaurant sector. But how do you balance your passion, success, and make a career in the industry too? Brendan Fong is the executive chef of Lily Moo in Parramatta, New South Wales. Brendan, how are you going?
Good, thank you.
It's good to have you on the show. You originally weren't going to be a chef and you ignored your parents' wishes and went for it. Tell us about that period of time.
Oh, well, it's like back in school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I kind of had a feeling that I wanted to cook. Like it was always something that I was interested in. And my parents kind of, you know, didn't really want me to be a chef because, you know, they saw some people in our family have taken that path and they haven't really, you know, been successful at it. so they saw that and they didn't want that for me. And it came to, you know, I was in year 12, I was studying and I wanted to drop out. They told me not to, you know, to study. So I finally found something that I wanted to do, which was, you know, I was very good with like, you know, building stuff and solving problems and doing stuff with my hands. So industrial design was like something that, okay, maybe I can give that a go. So the last 3 months of school, I kind of just, you know, studied a little bit and tried to aim for that. And then like just the whole process of studying was, you know, just wasn't for me. I'm still not good at it now, to be honest with you, but, you know. but, yeah, and then I decided I wasn't going to do it, wasn't going to go to uni, and then just fell into my parents kind of just gave up and just, okay, just go work in the kitchen, you know. you know, so, and then that's what happened. I guess we're here.
Well, you've built an incredible career since that moment that we can get into, but you're originally from Fiji. Tell us what food was like as a kid in your family and the move to Australia.
Yeah, I mean, like my parents are from Fiji. They migrated here. Well, I can't remember. I think it was like over 40 years ago from Fiji to work in, you know, they came from Fiji to kind of give us my sister and my older sister and my brother a better life. So they moved to Melbourne and they were working like 7 days a week, constantly like 2 to 3 jobs just to try and get by to kind of, you know, give us what we wanted and what we, you know, like I said, a better life. And in that they'd always look after us in terms of food, you know, we never went hungry. And it was like growing up with Fijian food, it was, you know, very based around coconut milk and, you know, onions and tomatoes and braises and stuff like that, which is, you know, it was different to see, to go to other people's houses, you know, friends' houses and see they're having like steak and stuff. He's like, what's this? But it was refreshing, you know.
Tell us about that, the first couple of years of your apprenticeship. What was it like in the kitchens that you worked in? Do you have any stories of that time?
I remember that my first job was, you know, the first time I ever stepped into a kitchen on a, you know, not as being a kitchen hand or a dishwasher. It was at Jordan's Seafood in Darling Harbour, and they were doing like, it was, you would do close to like 800 people a night.
Wow.
And I was on the fish and chip section. being a first year apprentice, you know, I didn't even know how to fry chips. So, yeah, like that was a big eye opener to see. And, you know, to be fair, to go on a big scale like that, I probably stitched myself up a little bit at the time. But now that I look at it, it was a great eye-opener into doing large volume, which kind of, I think, kind of helped me settle into Mr. Wong a bit. Just being used to doing those numbers and stuff like that.
What was those early days when you were doing your apprenticeship? What was a real key restaurant that you worked at that helped you believe that the chefing was really for you?
I think the main eye opener was working at Favreau, really. Just seeing that level of commitment that the other chefs put in. And the amount of hard work, like I remember we used to start work about 10 in the morning. So it wasn't that early. But we used to finish at like midnight, but we'd never stop the whole day. Like it would just be you. And we only did dinner service. We only did lunch on Fridays back then. And I just remember whenever you step in that kitchen at 10, it was just like, you know, full on, like you don't stop. You're 100%. Or nothing. sorry, excuse me. You're 100%, or you're sitting down, and you don't sit down the whole day. Like it was just, you know, that. I think it was that kind of like, you know, you're exhausted, but that at the end of the night on a Friday night you go out and you have fun, or on a Saturday night you go out and you party. So it was that kind of like work hard, play hard thing that was really exciting.
That was Daryl Felstead's restaurant, which was, he came from that incredible alumni from Bank Restaurant. And that was his first restaurant by himself. What was it like working with him?
It was great. Like, you know, just to see the way he thought about food. And I remember, like, cause I had no experience in that kind of that level, you know, going back then. And it's just seeing like his philosophy was like always, you know, try and think of something different, like reimagining food. Like I remember doing crab ice cream and I was like, who the hell does crab ice cream? Like, what the hell is this? But then when you actually try it, you're like, oh, that's pretty good. Like, you know, it was those kind of flavor combinations that were like, that I used to think like, how does this guy think of all this stuff? You know? And just the, like the kind of, well, I didn't say imagine a kind of creativity that he had. Like I remember one dish was like hibiscus with black sesame and scallops and kangaroo, I think. And that was like, you know, like no one would ever pair those ingredients together, but somehow he just made it work. And it was, you know, that's what I enjoyed. That's why I enjoyed working for him, because he had those quirky ideas that just kind of, you know, you'd read it on a menu and be like, well, you know, I'm not eating that. But then you'd actually see it on the plate and taste it and you're just like, wow.
Your career has been filled with all sorts of cuisines and different experiences. Tell us about some of them and the real integral moments and why you headed into the different cuisines.
I think I remember my head chef, my first ever head chef, Roy, from Jordan's. He would always tell me, like, the first thing he ever said to me was, you know, don't stay in one place for too long. Broaden, always be learning, and to try and like broaden your horizons into different cuisines, you know, because you can't always do. Well, you say you can, but you can't always do the same cuisine for the whole rest of your life. So I kind of took that, you know, to heart with me. And he was like, you know, back being a first year, you know, you'd listen to everything he'd say because, for one, he was pretty scary. And secondly, like, he had some now that I look back and think about those words that he told me, they were pretty wise words, you know, to tell somebody, you know, who's an apprentice. But, yeah, he basically just said, you know, just try and learn everything you can from anywhere, in any cuisine. So I took that to heart, and, you know, I went and did, you know, that modern style with Daryl, a little bit of Japanese at Toko, back in the day. This is when, you know, Kian Yu was there, and it was, you know, it was that was probably one of the busiest Japanese restaurants I've ever worked in. And then it was, I never really like wanted to do Chinese cuisine because just because I liked, you know, eating it so much. So I thought, you know, I always thought, you know, I'd never do that because I'd probably get sick of it. But then I ended up at Mr. Wong after working for Jeremy. And then that's kind of just like, you know, broadened the horizon of, you know, Chinese cuisine and how much I actually really like it.
You briefly mentioned you worked with Jeremy Strode at Bistrode CBD, the late Jeremy Strode. What was it like working with someone that was so adored and respected in the industry?
Like, to be honest with you, I really loved my time working there with him. And he kind of, you know, what he taught me was basically the philosophy of, you know, less is more. It's the less, you know, and it's one of the hardest things to do as a chef, you know, to kind of show restraint, you know. And he was like serving pieces of snapper with rocket and a lemon wedge and just some amazing olive oil, you know, and to have that confidence to do that, you know, and serve that in a restaurant. And I had, you know, his restaurant had a hat constantly, you know, and to have that confidence to do that, it was amazing to learn and to see that he knew his produce. And just, yeah, that's pretty much it really.
I know you've mentioned Mr. Wong quite a few times, but it had quite a massive impact, not only on your career, but so many lives in Sydney and so many careers as chefs. And it's one of the, you know, the really big restaurants of Sydney still. Tell us about what it was like working with that team and creating that amazing restaurant.
It was probably the best experience that I've had, after working there with so many great chefs. You know, you got Victor Leong that came from there, Zhao at Yu, working under those two was amazing. You know, they had so much talent came and still comes from that kitchen, and especially working under Dan. You know, it's one of the best probably places or decisions I've ever made working for those guys. And then after, you know, working there and kind of taking over after Jowett, you know, that's they're massive shoes to fill. You know, because Jowett's, you know, he's a legend in this in the industry, you know, as well as Dan. So it was quite tough. You know, I learned quite a bit about not only myself, but I learned how to, you know, manage teams and, you know, that kind of, and to think on a big scale and, to, you know, and how to run such a big restaurant like that. It was a very big eye opener.
As head chef for the first time in such a big, important restaurant, what was it like winning the incredible accolades that the restaurant received?
It was, you know, like because that was my first head chef job, it was quite difficult to start, just because, like I said before, you know, there were massive shoes to fill, and to kind of retain those awards that, you know, that those they had achieved was a great feeling, but it was probably one of the most difficult things, you know, that I've kind of undertaken. But satisfying to know that, you know, you can do it.
Mr. Wong is notorious for having celebrities and high-profile guests from all over the world. Do you have any stories of your time there and some experiences of those sort of guest dining at the restaurant?
I remember one night sitting, I think it was a Friday or Saturday night, and I was sitting at the counter after work, just having a chat with one of my sous chefs, and this person walks up and just goes, "Oh, this is a great meal. Like, you know, best we've had since Hong Kong or in Hong Kong." Excuse me. And I looked at him. I was like, "Oh, thanks, man. Like, you know, thank you for the kind words." And I looked and I shook his hand, and it was Jean-Claude Van Damme. And I was like, I just looked up and I was like, "Oh crap!" Like. okay. And I shook his hand, just like, you know, pretended, you know, oh yeah, thank you very much. And then he walked off, and then I was just like, okay, what just happened? But yeah, we met like a lot of celebrities, and we were lucky enough to cook for them, you know, including celebrity chefs like Rene Redzepi. I think Dave Chang came in. yeah.
You mentioned that you wanted to veer away from cooking Chinese food because you didn't want to get sick of it. But at Mr. Wong, you were open up to the world and made a real name for yourself. Tell us what you love about cooking the cuisine and why that switch changed from steering away to really love cooking it.
I just think, like, because I was so, like, I don't know why I actually thought like that when I was younger. I think it was kind of just me being an idiot, really. And then after working with like Dan and Zhao and seeing how much passion they have for that cuisine, and not only Chinese cuisine, but just Asian cuisine in general, it kind of ignited something in me that actually, you know, really wanted to keep doing it. And there's everybody thinks that Chinese food is just, you know, it's just what you get at your local Chinese shop, you know, like, you know, sweet and sour pork, all that kind of stuff. But it's so broad, and there's so many different areas, like cuisines and different flavor profiles, you know, and even each country is different. Like, you know, you get American Chinese, you get Australian Chinese, it's all different, you know. And it's good. It's interesting to see how that one dish varies between different countries. And I think that's why, you know, I kind of just like to stick with it, because it's more interesting to me.
You ended up leaving Mr. Wong and you headed overseas to London. Tell us about that period of time, because you were in London when the pandemic started.
Yeah, so I moved over to London, I think it was 3 years ago, I think, from now. Well, 4 years now, I think. And it was basically, I was going over to open my own restaurant with a business partner. And then the first thing I had to do was help open his diner concept. And then it kind of just like, it just dragged on after a while. And then we were in the stages of planning, like, I think it was like 2 years later, we were in the stages of planning a restaurant. And then it was ready, like the design was ready, everything was ready, and then the pandemic struck. So basically I was at that point where, you know, I didn't know what was going to go on. So we were planning to move to America, and then we couldn't go to America from there, so we just came back right before London went into lockdown, and I think Australia was already in lockdown then.
You came back and had to do mandatory isolation in Sydney. How are you feeling at that time, having sort of lost the opportunity of opening your own restaurant and finding yourself back in an environment where restaurants were sort of closing and forced into takeaway?
To be honest, it was a little bit gutted, because we couldn't open our restaurant in London after, you know, so long, you know, planning and having everything, like going over that process of getting everything ready to actually end that excitement you get when you're designing and you're picking everything, and, you know, and then all of a sudden it just gets stripped away from you. It was a bit upsetting. But returning back, we just have to think, you know, it is what it is. You know, we have to think about it in a positive way. And, you know, it was lucky that we didn't, because, you know, if I was still there, you know, we would have gone, like, you know, almost a year with an empty site and would have been burning through money. So, you know, as gutted as I was, I've got to look at it from a positive point of view, where we, you know, I actually escaped it. Yeah, escape kind of losing that amount of money and also, like, you know, being in a safe country like Australia was back then. You know, Australia, we were leading the most safest country back then with the virus. So it was good to be back into somewhere where it was safe rather than stay in London, where London was really bad.
Well, what did you do once you first got settled here? And like, how did you find an income to sustain yourself?
Well, basically I started doing private dinners in people's houses. So I'd create like a tasting menu, or banquet menu, like two different banquet menus. And then, you know, they would pick and it was all word of mouth. So I never did any, I never advertised it to anybody. And I think I started it in, was it April? April or May. So I did it in, I think it was May. So I started that in May, and then I would only do it I started my first one. And ever since then, I was booked out every week. And that was how I'd find the income to start off with, because like I actually didn't know how long we were going to be here for, because we had this plan. We were moving to New York. And then we thought, okay, we come back to Australia. We stay here for about 3 months. So it's kind of why I didn't find a job, why I didn't actually look for work, because I thought, oh, we're not going to be here for that long. So I don't want to commit to anything. I don't want to waste anyone else's time by committing to somebody and then I have to leave. So I started doing private dinners, and I actually found that the dinners through one of my friends is like, why don't you do a dinner? Like, just come to my house, cook a dinner for my friends. And, you know, and then, you know, we'll go from there. And he goes, I'll pay all the costs and all that stuff. I said, okay, fine, I'll do it. So I did that dinner. And then that week, my phone was just going crazy. Because, you know, people were scared to go into the city to eat. And they wanted that restaurant experience from home. So I thought, okay, I said to my wife, let's just do this for however long it takes till we have to go. So we went out, we bought like all this equipment, like plates, chopsticks, all that kind of stuff, you know, to people's houses. And then we started doing that every week until like, I think it was like till October or maybe before that.
How different was it cooking in people's homes compared to working in commercial kitchens?
Oh, it's very different. Because, you know, everybody's house is different, and the size of the kitchen is different. The bench space they have is different. The stove is different, even to like the space they leave you in the fridge is different. So it's, you know, it has its challenges. Like, and then if you forget something, like say for instance, you forget a chopping board, you know, you can't really rely on their stuff, because for one, I don't like to go through their stuff or to use their equipment, even though they're like, they welcome you to, you know, go through it. But it's just like, you know, you're very comfortable with the stuff you have, and, you know, using your own equipment. It's like, you know, when you take the same notepad everywhere, right? You used to write on that notepad. You take if you forget your chopping board, use your stuff. You know, so it's like, so working in people's kitchens is very difficult. And especially PowerPoints, where we have the luxury in a commercial kitchen for PowerPoints. You know, some kitchens I went, they only had like one PowerPoint.
Wow.
So yeah, it was a bit of a challenge.
You mentioned that you did these private dinners until October. What changed?
I missed, you know, like, it was fun, and you know, it was great to meet new people in people's houses. But you miss the stress of a service, you know, of a service where you have a full team behind you. You have, you can see like a restaurant that's full, and that, you know, when it gets busy, it's that excitement when it's busy. That's what I missed. And it's a different type of stress cooking in someone's house than it is to cooking in a restaurant. And I miss that feeling of a real busy service, which is, you don't get that cooking in someone's house where, you know, you cook a dish, you only cook like one or two portions and that's it. Like if it's a banquet, you know, so you really miss that pressure, you know, and which I really like that feeling. It sounds weird, but I really like that kind of stress of being under the pump, being busy. And that was what I was lacking.
Tell us about Lily Moo. How did that introduction with Ibi and George come about and the creation of this restaurant?
Oh, so I was introduced to Ibi through Jad from the picnic. Well, he doesn't have the picnic anymore, but Jad introduced me to Ibi. Ibi reached out and said, oh, can you come in? You know, we'll have a meeting and, you know, I want to chat to you about some ideas that we have. So I'm like, okay. So I thought, okay, well, I'll just go, you know, because again, we didn't know how long we're going to be here for. And it was going to be and they explained this idea. They had like this development out in Parramatta Square. And they were explaining it. They wanted Asian, you know, and they wanted this, they wanted that. And I was like, okay, cool. It sounds pretty interesting. It sounds pretty exciting. But I had the thought of, you know, Parramatta, do I really want to work out there? You know, like, because I still had that old thinking of how Parramatta was. So then I was like, okay, you know what? I'll just, you know, and it wasn't October. It was June, July. So, and I was still doing private dinners at the time. So I was introduced to him in July or June, July, and I was doing private dinners plus going to see Ibi and all that kind of stuff. So I went to the meeting with him and he explained the site and it was like, you know, it looked great. And he had this idea of what he wanted. And then I was just, and they already had a consultant. So the consultant that they had, I think he was in Perth. So he came back and he couldn't do it because he was opening his own restaurant. Because, you know, as you know, you can't sit still. You know, you've got to keep moving otherwise because in these times you don't know where your income's going to come from. So then it was like, I was like, oh, okay, I won't do it. I kept saying no. And then I was like, you know what? You know, I'm just going to do it. I'm bored. I'm sick of doing these private dinners because, for one, it's a lot of work, private dinners, to try and do it at home. And I didn't have a commercial space to prep any of this stuff in, so trying to prep at home is quite difficult. So I was like, okay, I'll stop the private dinners and then I'll help you do this. And then he had this idea of what he wanted. So I was like, okay, tell me what you exactly what you want. So then that, you know, he wanted stuff like, a bit of Japanese, a bit of this, a bit of that. And I was like, okay, why try and be one something from everywhere when we can just identify ourselves as just one thing? And he was like, okay, what do you want to do? So okay, just let me do a tasting for you and then we'll go from there. So then I had my sous chef from back when I was at Mr. Wong, he wasn't working at the time. So I was like, okay, what are you doing? So I got a job for you. He's like, okay, I'll do it. So I was like, okay, you be the head chef, because I didn't know how long, like, it was just a consultancy thing for me. You know, I was just going to work there for a little bit and then that was it. Leave it to Bas and he can take it. So I thought, like, what is like the easiest way that I can create a menu so that Bas can, after I go, Bas can take the torch and run with it. So I thought, okay, well, we both worked at Mr. Wong. My father's background is Chinese. Bas's background is Thai. And he had a Thai restaurant, well, in Haymarket, and he closed that. So I thought, okay, how about we combine the two together? Because, you know, they can work. And then we did this tasting, combining, like, you know, Thai dishes in Chinese and Chinese in Thai. And it wasn't like, it wasn't a fusion where we were just putting it together for the sake of it. You know, we thought about, you know, we were taking Chinese dishes and kind of injecting, looking for something that was similar and combining the two. And that's how the style of Lily Moo was kind of born, really.
Do you have any examples of dishes that you created at that time that sort of reflect that?
Well, it's kind of like, you know, we were taking dumplings and like, because I always, you know, dumplings are a seller. So we thought, you know, instead of like making it normal prawn mixed dumpling, we'd take the mix, make that tom yum flavored, and then serve it with a white, like a soy dressing, but also add fish sauce to make it taste like tom yum soup. So it was kind of like, you know, it's examples like that, that, you know, kind of work for us. And even, I guess that was the best example.
Tell us what it was like pulling this restaurant together in Parramatta. You originally were hesitant about bringing a restaurant of that ilk to Parramatta. What were some of the challenges?
So basically, like, working in Parramatta, I was like, okay, because I live out, you know, about 40 minutes from Parramatta. So I was like, okay. From what I remember, Parramatta wasn't like the safest area back then, from what I remember. So he was like, okay, just come to the site. Just come and see it. Right. I said, like, okay, I'll go out with you. We'll go see it. So when I actually went out and saw it, I was like, okay. It was a new development, and I didn't expect Parramatta to be like that. It was all brand new. And I didn't even feel like I felt like I was in the city, to be honest with you. So I was like, okay, it's got a bit of promise. The hardest part from that day that I decided to do it is we had 4 months to get the menu ready, to do the plates, plateware, to buy all the equipment, to find staff, to decide, you know, where to actually finish designing the kitchen, because the kitchen was half designed. And, you know, there were things we couldn't move, things we could move, and to try and exit, you know. So, and we didn't have a menu, like a proper menu. So we couldn't design the kitchen properly until we had that menu right. The hardest part was getting everything ready within the time frame that we did. It was difficult, but we got there.
Well, the restaurant has been a real success since it has opened. What's the response been like from locals? Do you have any stories that you can tell us about?
Look, to be honest with you, it's been different. You know, we were lucky enough to have regulars within the first 6 weeks of opening, and these guys were coming back 2 to 3 times a week. You know. We've got one guest that comes in, you know, every week on the same, you know, they'll come in every day and they'll order the same thing. And they love it, you know? So it's, you know, to have that kind of following so early in the early stage of a restaurant, I couldn't even believe it. Like I said, this never happens. But I think because it was something new that is in that area, and people don't have to go to the city for that quality. That's what brought them here. We were lucky to have that following within the first, you know, few months.
With that 4 month period to create a menu, is there a dish or two that you can tell us about that's starred on the menu?
I think everyone kind of loves the duck that we do, which is quite unique. We take the whole duck, we take the legs, and we cut the legs off, just leaving the crown. We debone the legs, mince it, and make that into like a lao sausage, which is like, you know, plenty of garlic, glutinous rice, and salt. And then we stuff that underneath the skin of the breast. Almost like how, you know, when you roast a chicken, you put the butter underneath the skin. And then we hang that. We hang it to dry in the cool room, like where a fan is, for about 2 days. And then we roast it like a Chinese-style duck. So it comes out golden. And then we slice that finely and put that on the plate with some sauce, which we you know, it's kind of similar to the duck sauce that you get when, you know, when you go to the barbecue, your local barbecue, your Chinese barbecue that you eat with rice. It's similar to that sauce, but then we just kind of inject more Southeast Asian flavor with kaffir lime, lemongrass, coconut palm sugar, and stuff like that.
You mentioned you originally took the gig just as a short-term consultancy gig, and yet you're still there as executive chef. Well, what kept you there, and what do you love about the restaurant?
I like that kind of creativity that we have. You know, it's something new that I've never done before. And trying to learn Thai cuisine, it's quite difficult because, you know, I don't have the greatest knowledge in Thai food. So Buzz teaches me a lot about that. And it's also the people, you know, the team that I have, we've got a great team. And they're really loyal, and they're hardworking. And also, like, you know, people like Ibi and George, they're great to work with because they're personable, and, you know, we can have a chat, and it's not like, you know, you don't feel like you can't approach anybody there. I think it's mainly the people that kind of makes me stay there.
You're currently experiencing another lockdown in Sydney. What's this period of time been like for you? You're in London, you were meant to go to New York, you ended up in Sydney, and now you have an amazing restaurant, but you're in lockdown. What sort of impact has it had on you?
The first week was great because, you know, I was like, okay, I get a bit of a break. You know, we had to take a step back and have a bit of a rest. The team gets rest, so we're all happy, you know, like we didn't think of it as being so bad. Now that it's dragged on, you know, because for so long, it's a bit frustrating, but I'm just trying, it is what it is. I'm just trying to kind of see the positive note from it. Like, it's giving me time to reflect on how I can improve the menu, how I can improve the service, how I can improve, the flow of the kitchen, and how, you know, so that it makes it easier for the team, the guys, makes it easy for the chefs, I should say. So it's given me a lot of time to reflect and to be able to kind of improve the business and operationally before I go back. I think that's the kind of, it's the only way that I can kind of look at it and kind of move through this lockdown without kind of going insane or being bored. You know,
Ibi and George have been building quite an amazing stable of restaurants in their group, including Lily Moo. Is there plans in the future to create more of what you're offering in other locations?
I don't know if I can say that. I think that, you know, there is plans to kind of, you know, bring Lily Moo closer to the city. Time will have to tell. We can't say just yet.
Well, Brendan, that is an intriguing answer, and it's great to have you on Deep in the Weeds today to hear your story. Please keep in touch, and we'll catch up again soon.
Will do. Thanks for having me, man.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.